I'd like to invite you to open your Bibles to Mark chapter 5. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving week. Many in our church have shared with me that they've had a good week. It's not been without pain and struggles with some in our church family. But we've all come through the week with much to be thankful for. And Thanksgiving Day seems to serve as a gateway into the holiday season. And we're going to be seeing more and more guests and visitors coming into our homes and here with our church. My wife and I were able to drive to Western New York this past Wednesday to spend Thanksgiving with my sister just outside of Corning, New York. And we drove home yesterday, and we had a great time. And the scale this morning said I had a fantastic time while I was gone. And I'll have to pay for those sins now this week. But Maybe you have different Thanksgiving memories. I have several from the years. There was one point in my family's life where we had the joy of being part of a church that every Thanksgiving morning, every year, they would have a Thanksgiving Day service. It was at 10 o'clock in the morning. So you got the parades in, and then you got your cinnamon rolls down, and every year it was 10 o'clock, and it packed the house out. Even people from in town would come to that service on Thanksgiving morning. And as the pastor would promote this particular service, every year he would say, "Now, we're going to have our Thanksgiving morning service again this year. It's at 10 o'clock." And then he'd always say this. He'd say, "And you can set your turkey by it." He says, "We will be done at 11. Every year we were done at 11 o'clock. And he said this. He always said, "You can set your turkey by it." And he was right. We've all enjoyed our turkey this past week. Now, I've heard stories from time to time of people who, well, they left their turkey in the oven too long. Have you ever experienced that? Have you ever burnt your turkey on Thanksgiving or on Christmas morning? What good is a burnt turkey? Well, someone has put together five reasons you can be thankful you burned your turkey this year. Reason number one, uninvited guests will think twice next year. Okay? That's one blessing. Another reason you can be thankful you burned your turkey is that your cheese, broccoli, lima bean casserole will this year gain newfound appreciation. People didn't used to eat it, right? A third reason, I like this one. A third reason you can be thankful you burnt your turkey this year is that carving the turkey will provide a good cardiovascular workout. Burn calories before you eat them, right? And a fourth reason you can be thankful you burned the turkey is now you get to dessert quicker. And then one more reason you can be thankful, according to this author. Thankful that you burnt the turkey this year. And it's this. After dinner, the guys can take the bird to the yard and play football with it. It's good. But on a serious note, perhaps you had a family tradition this past Thursday at the Thanksgiving table. Or maybe you'll do this at the Christmas table here in a few weeks. The tradition where, you know what I mean, you go around the table, and everyone gets to say what they're thankful for in the past year. And you go around the table so that everyone has to speak. And they have to give praise to Jesus for something that they're thankful for. It could be something they're thankful for with regards to their job that year, or with regards to the family, or with regards to the fact that Detroit beat Green Bay in Green Bay. It could be any of these things. But I want you to use your imagination with me this morning. Perhaps you're at a table, going around the table, and everyone at your table is saying what they're thankful for this year. But there's a stranger at your table this year. You've never met him personally, though you've read about him. I wonder what it would be like if the guy from Mark chapter 5 was sitting at your Thanksgiving table this year. And he had a turn to say why he was so thankful. You say, well, who's the guy in Mark chapter 5? Well, we refer to him as the maniac of Gadara. And his story takes up 20 verses in Mark chapter 5. I wonder, what would it be like if this guy was sitting with your family and his turn came around where he had to say what he was thankful for? I don't have to wonder what he would say. His story would have four parts to it. He would say something like this, "Well, I can tell you what I'm thankful for. I can never get over my story. And I can tell you right when it started. And he would say, first of all, I'm thankful for a condition I couldn't change. A condition I couldn't change. I see this in Mark chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, as we pull into the story. Verse 1, they, Jesus and the disciples, came to the other side of the Sea of Galilee into the country of the Gerasenes. And when he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met Jesus. What in the world are we seeing in verses 1 and 2? What we're seeing is a man whose life is in a careless, hopeless condition. Now, it's important as we pull our chairs up to this narrative that we see where it lands in the Gospel of Mark, of course. And you might remember that back in Mark chapter 4, we have the story of Jesus calming a sea and a storm. He's calming what's going on in the water and above the water. And he's calming it with his word. Let's be reminded of this storm. Look at Mark chapter 4, verse 35. And on that day when evening came, he said to them, his disciples, let us go over to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind. And the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. And Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and they said to him, Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? And he got up and he rebuked the wind and he said to the sea, Hush, be still. And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And then he said to them, Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? And they became very much afraid. And they said to one another, Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? Can you imagine that scene? I've never been in a boat. Growing up, we lived on a lake, and I had a canoe, a rowboat, and a pontoon. I would never had any of those craft out on the water in a storm like this. I mean, the closest thing I've ever been, and this is going way back to my childhood, is I was on the Boblo boat on the Detroit River. And we were coming home coming from Boblo back to port there in Detroit. And it was a very windy, rainy, freezing kind of evening. It was just really cold. I don't remember what time of year and what, but I just remember, this is miserable. Well, why is it miserable, Jim? Because I'm getting wet and I'm cold and it's windy. But we were never in danger. I can tell you stories that I've received from Navy sailors of storms that they've taken their craft through. And those are some major storms. But when I come to Mark chapter 4, it is so bad. These crafts are so small, and they're already filling with water. The storms on the Sea of Galilee would start with little warning, and the wind would shoot down between two mountain peaks just offshore, and it would just stir the thing up as if someone were just shaking that lake. It would get stirred up and swirled up, and these little boats are filling with water. They're taking on water. This is a horrific storm. Yet Jesus is sleeping. And they wake him up and he goes out and he says to the sea and to the storm, that's enough. And immediately, it's still. There's only one thing still moving, and it's the disciples. They're shaking in their sandals, saying, what just happened and how can he do that? That's the end of Mark chapter 4. And while that's a very, very important narrative demonstrating the deity of the Son of God to his disciples and to us as the readers, it's also an introduction to a storm that we're going to meet here in Mark chapter 5. And the storm we're going to meet in Mark chapter 5 is way worse than anything we saw in Mark chapter 4. You see, the man we're meeting in Mark chapter 5, the man who, by the way, is sitting at your Thanksgiving table giving his testimony, what he's thankful for. He would say, man, I had a condition I couldn't change. My condition was an internal storm. He says, let me tell you about my life. Let me tell you how bad it was. Outwardly, I was too far gone to be helped by any other human. No human could help me. Matthew records this account as well, and he gives us more details. He says that this man also had a partner. As bad as this guy was, he had help. Matthew also tells us that he was especially violent. This man was not just a troubled man who would stand next to you in a crowd and just would keep his head down. If you were within reach of this man at any given point of the day in any place, your life was in danger. It was so bad that according to Mark chapter 5, he had to be incarcerated or put into chains on a number of occasions. Look at verses 3 and 4. He had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Luke adds another detail. You picture this man with the darkness around him and in him. So strong, physically strong, animated with demonic strength, doing violence to anyone within reach. And if they weren't close enough, listen, he would rush to them to harm them. But on top of all that, Luke gives us another detail. He was naked. What a condition. And this sure was a dark situation. And it was bad for business, too, for the local merchants who were primarily Gentile, who dealt with swine in that area. That was his condition outwardly. But it gets worse. Inwardly, the storm was even more violent. You see, inwardly, this man would tell you at your Thanksgiving table, it was so bad that I could have been called the living dead. Though living, I dwelt among the dead. It says that he, in verse 3, he had his dwelling among the tombs. His dwelling was with those who had long ago died. No doubt as he had his abode there, he was constantly, daily reminded of what awaited him. And the storm right now that was in his life and in his very body would someday give birth to a worse storm, and that's eternal separation from God. He said, man, I had a condition I couldn't change. It was so bad. Look at verse 5. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains and gashing himself with stones. When I had the privilege of teaching biblical counseling class to some grad students in Alexandria, Egypt, we flew into Cairo. I think this is back in 2003 or 2004. We flew into Cairo and stayed there a few days just to go under the radar. And then someone came, I don't know who it was, with vans, and they picked the four of us teachers up and drove us to Alexandria, Egypt, right on the Mediterranean Sea. I forget, it was a couple hours away, I think. And they deposited us into a compound with walls and guards. And it was a Christian compound. It was actually a Christian camp, evangelical Christian camp. Did a lot with the Billy Graham Association, I believe, and some other organizations. And it was there that we had our lodging in our classroom for the next week and a half. And we felt pretty safe in there. We felt pretty safe. Boy, I got in trouble on that trip. One of the other professors and I, we got a little claustrophobic in the compound. So one time when we weren't, neither one of us were teaching, we snuck out. And we walked around the compound, past housing, down to the Mediterranean Sea shore, because we wanted to stick our piggies in the sea there and say that we had been in the Mediterranean Sea. And then we walked back, and boy, we got in trouble. They said, don't you ever leave the compound again. You kind of look American, right? And but I'll never forget this. Every day, the Muslims that surrounded that compound knew that there was Christian activity in that compound. And every day, all through the day, the calls for prayer came over the loudspeakers, and they had special loudspeakers focused on that compound. It was so loud that when the calls to prayer happened every day, we would have to stop lecturing and just wait. And as an American, I was a little, oh boy, here we go again. But you know what? I learned something from the Egyptian Christians, the Egyptian brothers. They would say, hey, you know what? Those are our unsaved brothers. We're in here training to reach. And they loved them. And their calls to prayer became the brothers' call to prayer for their salvation. But it was so loud, we had to stop. It was only intrusive a couple times a day. But this man in Mark 5 could be heard screaming constantly, whether it's from the graveyard or from the mountains, where in the mountains you don't know where his location is and you want to know where it is because he's violent. This man's presence was felt by everyone all the time. What a storm. And it was so, we say, why was he screaming? It was the turmoil, the demonic presence within him, and the agony on the outside. It was so bad. The end of verse 5 says that he gashed himself with stones. You say, is cutting in the Bible? This is one of the places it is. So much turmoil. And let me say this about demonic activity. Demonic activity is always focused on taking away from God's glory revealed in man. Demonic activity is so destructive to the image of God preserved in man, and that's being renewed in those who are believers. I don't believe believers can be indwelt. That's obvious. But there is far more demonic activity in our world than we want to admit. Even here in the West. I mean, do I need to bring Dr. Bob up here to tell you about what's going on in Africa? You say, well, that's where it's clear. I'm just going to say it's a lot clearer here in the West than you want to admit. Just watch the headlines. Watch what's going on in Capitol Hill. Watch what's going on in Hollywood recently in the last few weeks. It's just a glimpse of the demonic activity that's going on in our country. This man knew all about this. Pastor Kent Hughes, when he pastored College Church in Wheaton, said these words to his congregation. It's as if he had to pause for a minute as he described this man's agony. And he said, quote, this man was running wild, naked, unkempt, and ill. And as a result, all were against him. Little children fled at his approach. Even in his lucid moments, he surely realized how repulsive and unloved and unwelcome he was. What unutterable misery, end quote. So as this guy speaks up at your Thanksgiving dinner table or your Christmas table, he said, yeah, I know what I'm thankful for. You see, I had a condition that I couldn't change. Huh. But then there was that appointment, an appointment I didn't make. Look back at verses 1 and 2 again. They, Jesus and his disciples, came to the other side of the sea into the country of the Gerasenes. And when he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And we have the description in verses 3 through 5 Fast forward to verse 6. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. There was something familiar about this appointment, if you will, that was normal for this man. And then there's something abnormal about this appointment. This man saw Jesus and his disciples come into his region, come up on his shore. I've had the joy of standing in Tiberias on one side of the Sea of Galilee, and you on a clear day can discern five miles away the far shores. And you can look to your right as you stand at Tiberias, and you can see a mountainous rugged area descending into the sea. That's this place. And Jesus and his disciples come to the shore, and this man that day was not in the mountains. He was near enough to see Jesus and his disciples bring his boat to shore. And what did this violent man do when someone came into his space? He would run towards him with violence. That was normal. But when he got close to this particular man, the closer he got, the faster he got down on his face before this man. This never happened like this before. This man is used to dominating whoever he's rushing. This normal assault, if you will, turned into a heavenly trap. Where he would normally terrorize merchants coming up onto that very seashore, it was this time the man that was being pursued. That specific day, that specific place, with that specific man. That's an appointment, he would say to you. It's an appointment I didn't make. And then there was the third part to my story. There was a power I hadn't anticipated. A power I had not anticipated. Now, I don't know if this man's strength, his demonic strength, was betrayed by a physical appearance that looked strong, or maybe he was like Samson, of small stature, but still amazing strength, which was puzzling to someone who would look on. But I know this about this man. However long he'd been in this condition, which had been for a significant amount of time, he knew strength. He knew power. He knew what he was capable of in his body due to the demonic animation. But he'd never seen this kind of power. He would say, I remember at this appointment, this man, Jesus, he had a fourfold power that I couldn't come close to with my power. So what do you mean a fourfold power? Well, Jesus, this man, had power over demons. Over demons. Look at verse 7. And shouting with a loud voice, he said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you, by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Same voice, not long before this, he said to the sea and the atmosphere, "Be still." Verse 9, and he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby in the mountain, and the demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." And Jesus gave them permission, and coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine. The man would say at your table, "I've never seen anything like this." I mean, this Jesus had a power I hadn't anticipated. He had power over demons, not singular, plural, not a few, thousands. Again, Pastor Kent Hughes said this, at this point, quote, "There was a host of evil spirits leering upon Christ from behind the poor man's wild eyes," end quote. And Jesus looked him in the eye, said, I'm talking to all of you. I'm talking to all of you. You do what I say, and you go where I say you go. And what did they do? Well, just like there was no hope for the ocean to rebel against his word or the atmosphere, nor for these demons, they immediately left this man. What did that next moment feel like for this guy? He had a fourfold power. First of all, he had power over demons, but he also had power over nature. And we saw that not only with the ocean and the atmosphere at the end of chapter 4, but look at the end of chapter 13. What happened after they were in the herd of swine? It says, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. As I said, I've seen those cliffs. I've seen that sharp decline into the ocean, and it would have been quite a show, quite a spectacle to have approximately 2,000 demonized swine commit suicide. Is that how you'd say it, I guess? One at a time over the cliff. And this man's watching it. What darkness was in those swine? And all that was in me. He had a fourfold power. He had power over demons. I mean, this Jesus had power over nature. And then he had power over people. Look at verses 14 and 15. And their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the country. They went everywhere reporting this. And the people came out to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus. Say, what did they say to Jesus? Verse 16. Those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And look at verse 17. And they began to implore him to leave their region. These weren't just a few ticked off swine caregivers. These were multitudes, a multitude from the country as well as in the city. This is the very livelihood of this part of the lake, the Sea of Galilee. They come out, look at their dead swine, look at this man, and they say to Jesus, we can't handle this kind of power here. We don't know what to do with you. We thought we could at times contain this man, but we don't know what to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth. This power is outside of what we can comprehend. Leave, please. He says there's a fourfold power with this guy. He had power over demons. He had power over nature. He had power over people. But his greatest display of power was his power over me. He showed me mercy. You know, sometimes we want to see God do something big. Still the ocean. Change the atmosphere. Give me a better job. Put a different person in leadership. God, do something big. When in reality, if you want to see God's greatest display of strength and power, just watch him when he rolls up his sleeves and he shows you mercy. That's power. Wow. I read the story of a man who in England went to a paper factory that was known for making the finest stationery. And one day, as he's touring this factory, the guy giving the tour says, you want to see what we make our fine stationery out of? I mean, the finest stationery you can find. And he was shown a huge pile of old rags. He says, we take old, dirty rags and make it into the finest stationery. And the man couldn't believe it. But 6 weeks later, he received a package of paper from the company with his initials embossed on it. And on the first page were written these words, "Dirty rags transformed." This man says, "You know what? That day, I ran into a power that I hadn't anticipated. And it took the storm and the mess that I was, that defined me, and changed me." But there's one more part to my story I'd like to tell you at this Thanksgiving table, he would say to you. He would say, "Finally, there was an assignment that I can't outlive. There's an assignment I cannot outlive." Look at verse 18. "As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him." That's an understatement. Say, what kind of a change? Look at verse 15. This is the guy who came to Jesus. The crowd came to Jesus and they observed this about this man. He had been demon-possessed, but now he's sitting down. And he is also clothed, and he's in his right man, in his right mind. And the very man who had had the legion was now visible and changed and transformed. That's the guy we're seeing in verse 18. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. And Jesus did not let him. But he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and he began to proclaim in Decapolis, the region of 10 cities, primarily Gentile population. He began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. Why? Because they knew this guy. They knew that voice. Everyone knew this guy. What did this man want to do? Well, he wanted the easy way out initially. He said, "You know what? I've really ruined everything here. No one here in the region of 10 Gentile cities will have anything to do with me. Can I just reset and start over with you, Jesus, and your team? Can I hang out with you? That would be easy and encouraging. That's the easy road. Let me start over from zero and you be my first 13 friends." And Jesus says, "No, don't take the easy way out. I want to give you a hard assignment. Go to those who knew you before and tell your story. Tell your story. Tell your story to your neighbors, to your family." Well, we don't hear anything more about this guy. Or do we? The region he spread the news in was called the Decapolis. Stay in this same gospel and go with me to chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. You see, Jesus is going to come into a certain region called, get this, Decapolis. And he's going to find the soil turned up. He's going to find these people very receptive to his ministry. Yeah, I wonder why. Verse 31, again, he, Jesus, went out from the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they implored him to lay his hand on them. How'd they know to bring the guy to him? Jesus took him aside from the crowd by himself and put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva, and looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be open." And his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. And he gave them orders not to tell anyone, but the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. They were utterly astonished, saying, "He has done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." It's like, wow, he didn't need much of an introduction into Decapolis. Why? Could it be that this man in Mark chapter 5 did what the Lord said and told his friends and family and loved ones? There's one named Jesus of Nazareth, and you knew me. You knew me. I'd even assaulted some of you, but look at me now. Listen, if you ever have a shot at having contact with Jesus of Nazareth, don't miss it. He says, yeah, I had an assignment that I can't outlive the rest of my life. The rest of my life. I get to tell my story. So, can you imagine this guy at your Thanksgiving table this past Thursday? Or at your Christmas table? Or at a family gathering between now and Christmas? And you're going around the table, and everyone has to say what they're thankful for, and it comes to this guy, and he says, yeah, I know what I'm thankful for. I had a condition I couldn't change. Then there was an appointment I didn't make. There was a power I hadn't anticipated, and now I have an assignment that I can't outlive. Wouldn't you just be astonished? Wait a minute. Maybe he was at your table Thursday. You see, as he turns to look at you, his face looks kind of familiar. It's you. I want to take you to one more passage before we close. Go to Ephesians chapter 2 with me. Ephesians chapter 2. You say, why are we coming to Ephesians 2? Why are we jumping out of the Gospels into the epistles? Because Paul's going to tell a very familiar story. Watch this. In verses 1 through 3, you had a condition you couldn't change. And you were dead, verse 1, in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lust of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. That was you on your best day going downhill with the wind to your back. You had a condition that you couldn't change. But you know what I see at the beginning of verse 4? There's an appointment you didn't make. It says, but God, being rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us. What is that? That's an appointment you didn't make. And you know what happened next? There was a power you hadn't anticipated. Look at verse 4 again. Because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, he made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. And not only that, he raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the ages to come he might show the surpassing riches of his grace and kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. That's a power you hadn't anticipated. It gave you life, placed you in Christ, and seated you in the heavenlies. You say, well, what happened next? Well, you know what happened next. Not only was there a condition you couldn't change, an appointment you didn't make, and a power you didn't anticipate, but there's an assignment now that you can't outlive. You cannot outlive. Again, look at verse 8. For by grace you've been saved through faith, and that's not of yourselves. It's a gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. And watch this. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand, that we would walk in them. And we have an assignment, verse 10, for the rest of our lives here. But when the rest of our lives here is done, we still have an assignment we can't outlive, because for all eternity, verse 7 says, we're going to be trophies of his mercy. This guy would tell his story for the rest of his life. He never got over it. And his story is your story. Or is it? This man didn't say he got religion. This man didn't say he went to a Christian school or college. This man didn't say that he completed a discipleship curriculum. No. He was remade. He was reborn. He was a new creation. So I'm not asking you today, do you got religion? I'm not asking you today how deep your history goes into the 75 years of this church. I'm not asking you this day if you have the MacArthur Study Bible. I'm asking you, is this your story? Or are you still in that condition that you cannot fix? You can put makeup on it, or you can educate it, but it's still dark. Now, I got some great news for you. You have an appointment right now with Jesus. He's coming for you to save you from what you cannot save yourself from. If this is your story, then let's learn something from the previous grave dweller. Let's go to our own people. Let's go to our friends and our family and tell them over and over and over again the impact of Jesus and his rescue of us. And you know what you're going to find Jesus doing? He's going to take your nouns and verbs, as imperfect as they come out, and he's going to use your story to draw people to him, to break up the ground, so that sometime down the road, possibly, they'll respond to the gospel. Do not stay silent. Let your thanksgiving year-round for your salvation be loud.